and tell me how you document, interpret, and document that bottom line. You should know by now, by the way.
I need to count the I's.
What's the rate?
120.
You already know that. And what's the PR interval?
I can't see.
You'll have to probably get on your computers or on your laptops and blow these up, but I would encourage you to do that at home. This is the same sinus rhythm that we've been looking at, okay? So you document that with a sinus check, okay? Now, some people will say sinus check with a PRI of and a QRS of, but most of the time, I don't think you'll find that in the average documentation. And there's a couple of reasons for that. It's not laziness. Again, it's because the technology now puts that in the record already. I have a issue with that because that depends on you going back and verifying. So I don't know. But, all right. What about that second one?
Atrial flutter.
So what is the criteria? If you were to describe atrial flutter.
LV wave.
Huh?
LV wave.
No P wave, but
it looked like short.
So you start out regular rate, regular rhythm, no discernible P wave, but with sharp tooth or sawtooth F waves. Then you would also, as you're documenting it, you would put A flutter, and be careful with AF. That AF is the abbreviation for atrial fib. So you'll have to write out flutter. A flutter with, what's the next part you want to document?
How many?
Yeah. What's the degree of the ratio of F waves to QRSs?
4-1.
4-1, that's right. Now, the next rhythm that we're going to talk about is a first cousin, but it is slightly different in morphology, certainly, but also in incidence. Many of the same people will have both, but atrial fibrillation is a little bit more common. In fact, it's a lot more common among our general population. It is where the SA node is not controlling the impulse wave. It's coming again from those very fragile and disrupted. Some area within that atrial tissue is actually driving the ship. So what you'll find in the criteria for atrial fib is usually a normal rate, but irregular. The R to R is very, there's no regularity to it at all. Irregular, and no discernible P wave. What you will see is this wavy looking line because somewhere between 350 and 600 little impulses are trying to come down those same internodal tracks. And luckily for these people, the AV node slows it down to where the ventricle doesn't fail. Now, many times there will be what's called an RVR, atrial fib with a very rapid ventricular response. Those individuals can run at pretty high rates, but typically it is varied because of that inconsistent, irregularity that you see. So irregular, no discernible P wave, and you'll see it with those who have COPD. Remember, the atrial dysrhythmias are very common in those with lung disease because of that pressure inside the lung, what it does to the right ventricle, and how fragile that atrial tissue becomes because of that. Through the right and left atrium, actually. The collection of clots within that and the wall motion is exaggerated, so it's kind of fragile. Anyway, So COPD or status post CABG, about 20-30% of those who have bypass surgery will go into atrial fib at some point. Aberrant atrial pathways, that's very common among our general population. It doesn't seem to be something that is solely an age-related thing. Many people will develop atrial fib and need treatment for it because the clinical significance, just as we saw with atrial flutter, is that loss of atrial kick and the collection of clots within the atrium and how much of a risk for stroke that is. In fact, it's such a high risk of stroke that there is a system, and I think your textbook mentions it, it's called the CHAD system, and it's just a way of, it's a method of describing the risk, putting someone in a category so that we know how aggressive we want to get with treatment. So, how do we treat both atrial flutter and atrial fib? Well, one is, of course, the Cardiazem, Diltiazem, and amiodarone. Both of those are very successful in converting atrial flutter and atrial fib. More atrial fib, though. Atrial flutter is a little harder to get out of atrial flutter than atrial fib. So we'll try the medication approach first. We can also try digoxin if it's not a crucial situation. Because remember, digoxin, why would we, if we needed to get this person into sinus rhythm as quickly as possible, why would digoxin not be where we, why would we not solely depend on dig?
It can call atrial fib, can it?
Do what?
It's going to layer it too much.
No.
Doesn't it cause atrial fib if there's too much of it?
They're toxic. But they're not toxic. We're just going to try this now. What do you know about digoxin that would make it not a good now?
It's got to build up to therapeutic levels.
What?
Go to level.
You have to get a level. Is that what someone was back there saying? Yeah. It takes 3 days for it to get really therapeutic most of the time. So, but we can use it in controlling it. And there is a time where there are many people who we can't get them out of it. They're chronic fibbers. That's what we call them. So then, with the knowledge that they've lost that atrial kick, that's the other clinical significance of atrial fib, we're going to put them on digoxin as a inotropic drug to build up their contractility to kind of make up the difference. What else are they going to have to be put on? Some kind of anticoagulant. Absolutely. They'll have to live on. Now, Eliquis is now the most common, I think, or Pradaxa. Coumadin, you do need to know for this exam because it's a black box drug. Y'all know that that means that you have a very high likelihood of seeing it on NCLEX. I can tell you have an even higher likelihood of seeing it on my exam. But Eliquis is one of the drugs. It has a little bit higher safety profile than Coumadin. Did you have a question? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you have do you have syncope episodes with AFib like you did with that six sinus or whatever?
Not usually. Unless their ventricular response is so varied, and it can be, I mean, they can be 40 one minute, 140 the next.
Right.
So that would make it very difficult for them to, you know, with someone who has very bad heart disease, to compensate for that kind of switch. Might make them a little dizzy when it drops down. So anticoagulation is with either Coumadin, Pradaxa, Eliquis, or even high, if they're not really wanting to put them on those, they can use high-dose Lovenox as well, 160, that kind of range. Usually what you give in the clinical setting for DVT prophylaxis is what? 30 to 40. It's based on kilogram body weight, but that's about it. But if we use it as an anticoagulant at 160, the profile for hemorrhage is still very low, no pun intended, but around the site, you would really be want to watch it, you know. So, and it's still not going to make any difference on the PTT because it's structurally different. So that's why it's kind of coming up. So do check out atrial fib on YouTube and see what happens when the heart is quivering. That's what's really hard to visualize unless you have seen it. And that atrium is just quivering like jello. Meanwhile, the ventricle's doing its thing. Any questions on AFib or AFib? Atrial fib. Now, if the medicines don't work, and we really want to try to get this new onset atrial fib out of atrial fib and into sinus rhythm because of the risk of stroke, we're going to use what's called cardioversion. When the drugs don't work, we'll use cardioversion. Cardioversion entails delivering a low level of electrical electricity guided by the QRS. Because remember, this person has a pulse. So one of the biggest safety mechanisms with cardioversion is to have the sync button on. On the defibrillator, there is a button that's called the sync button. It synchronizes, it matches or listens to that R wave. It doesn't hit on the anywhere else in the EKG. So, because think about it, if it just hit them arbitrarily, let's say on that vulnerable T part, what's it gonna do? It's gonna make them go into a worse rhythm without a pulse, probably, like, oh, VTAC or VFib, usually mean dip. So, that's the most important thing. Now, this is an elective procedure, typically. They do have the right to say no. They do have to sign consent. They will be, it's done under conscious sedation. Anybody work in the EK or know about conscious sedation? What's that entail? What's the nurse's part of doing any procedure with conscious sedation?
Have they ever had it before?
Huh?
You want to know if they've ever had it before? Like,
yeah.
Tell them what's going on.
You're going to educate them about the procedure. True. What is sample? Do you know what sample is? Signs and symptoms, allergies, medications. Y'all never heard of this? Last meal and the environment about around surrounding. We'll talk a lot more about sample with trauma. But in this case, assuming it's a new admit, you're going to get their history. But backing up, let's say this is someone who's been in atrial fib, and we're now going to try to convert them. We tried medication, so they've been admitted. So now what we'll do is bring the crash cart into the room, because it will have all the emergency equipment that you might need should things go south. Because we're dealing with electricity here. We're going to shock this person's heart back into a sinus rhythm. So anything can happen. So, you're going to make sure you have suction readily available and all of those emergency things, just in case they do. Like, the defibrillator sits on top of the crash cart, but you're going to make sure the sync button is on so it synchronizes to the R wave. We'll give them a small dose of usually, fentanyl and Versed, that's two drugs you want to be sure you look up. Fentanyl and Versed are used for a whole host of things in addition to conscious sedation procedures. Some centers do it under Diprovan, but you have to have an anesthesiologist. Why is that? Why do we have to have an anesthesiologist to give them propofol? It's a general anesthetic. It's outside your scope of practice, darlings. You need to know that. And by the way, when you get out, you'll be getting an email from the State Board of Nursing. If you're in Texas, you get monthly alert things when your practice issues come up. You need to be sure and read those because you're held accountable to that. But anyway, long story short, what we're going to then do, so make sure your emergency equipment is readily available, including suction and oxygen. We will probably put them on a little low nasal prong, maybe even a Vinny mask of oxygen. Sedate them with the fentanyl and Versed, watching very closely vital signs. During the procedure, you'll be doing vital signs every 15 minutes and then every 5 minutes during the procedure and then every 15 times an hour and then every hour for a couple hours after that. Some of these folks come in off, you know, like they're admitted and they're coming strictly for the cardioversion. And then they go home after they recover. So, emergency equipment, conscious sedation, and while they're, you know, short, it only takes a second to do the procedure. After the procedure, what are you watching for?
Heart rhythm,
Their rhythm, yeah. We're hoping to see a sinus rhythm and the crowd goes wild. But you just gave them fentanyl. So what could you see?
Respiratory depression.
So you want to watch their O2 set and their respiratory drive. Luckily, it has a fairly short half-life for the benzos, so it doesn't take them long to reverse that. But anyway, so that's what a cardioversion is like. Safety, safety, safety. Okay? Do I need to say it again? What's the biggest safety concern with cardioversion?
Synchronize.
Thank you. And one more thing. Before you hit the button, you say clear, clear, all clear. Even though you're giving that under controlled circumstances with that R wave, you want to make sure everybody's standing back. All right. Any questions about AFib or A flutter or any of those?
You said we monitor vital signs every 5 minutes during
the procedure. It only takes a second. But you'll get every five, like for probably 3 or 4 times, and then every hour. And then they usually, just for a couple of hours, they're usually stable if it's a successful cardioversion. Sometimes it doesn't work. We will escalate the dosage, just like with medications, watt seconds or joules, the amount of energy we use escalates up to 100 with atrial fib. Remember, we're dealing with somebody who's awake alert, and anything over that really, I mean, hurts bad. So then they'll usually keep them in and keep trying the medications. And again, some of these folks stay in atrial fib for a long time. On DIG or amiodarone or junctional rhythms come from the junction. The biggest thing about them, usually the rate and rhythm are normal. There's just no P wave. And if there is a P wave, it's kind of bizarre looking. So the rate varies. It can be accelerated as what they call a junctional escape or a junctional tachycardia. But they're usually kind of slow and steady in my clinical expertise or experience. P waves may be absent, inverted, or retrograde, which is really wild. I'll show you that in a minute. It originates in the AV node. It is a junctional rhythm. It originates. So the SA node has just stepped out, gone on vacation, AV node is taking over. Clinical significance? You guessed it, you lose your atrial kick. Most people do not tolerate a junctional rhythm very long, so they will require a temporary or permanent pacemaker. I've seen this after bypass surgery, and they usually do go back into their usual rhythm. But on the top, see how that P interval is real short? That's very characteristic. Either you will not have any P wave, or you'll have this really very, very short, less than 0.12 P interval. So you know it's not coming from the SA node. Remember, what's the timing going to be if it's coming from the SA node? 0.12 to 0.20. That's right. So that's a junctional rhythm. And this one is the wild one. This is now, remember how this happens is this. Remember, there's three ways in and one way out. So if it comes down this upper, then you'll have that shortened PR interval or no PR interval. If it comes mid, it'll be sometimes flipped over, but it'll still be there. If it comes down the lower one, it can be retrograde, which is really wild to see. I've only seen it once in my career. And but it looks like that. And you're like, what the heck? That's the P wave. But remember, it's not coming from the sinus node. It's coming retrograde. It's flipping over in the electrical transmission of the impulse is what you're looking at, right? That impulse, that wave of depolarization. Right? So that wave is coming down from the junction and kind of flipping up and coming down that lower pathway. So it's retrograde. It comes after the QRS, which is really pretty unique.
Wait, how is that possible? Explain that again.
It's called a reentrant pathway.
It's not time-wise.
You've got depolarization.
You have to think about it in terms of, it's not what's actually happening in the hearts, it's how the leaves are picking it up. They're picking it up later because it's coming a different route. It's sending the wave, but it's not sending it in the right location, so it backtracks back out, and then the leaves pick it up afterwards.
That makes sense.
Well, it is kind of bizarre, though, because it's a reentrant. Like, PVCs are reentrant. And it does actually come down the pike, and then it hits on a part of the pathway that's partial, it's already been depolarized, and is partly repolarized, and just enough for it to come back down that same pathway.
See, if I were looking at that, I would have followed it up.
I just said, you know, but anyway, now, so that's just the bizarrety of junctional rhythms. The big thing is the clinical significance is you lose your atrial kick. They will most probably have to be paced because of the risk of stroke, for one thing. They have that same risk. But more of what it does to cardiac output. They don't tolerate it typically very long at all before they start showing signs of cardiac compromise. Now, look at this one. I want to ask you, what do you think about that? Not only is it a junctional rhythm, because there's no P with wave, but what's going on with that?
It's building. It's like it's not letting the electrical current out of it.
It's nothing to do with the heart.
Are you
talking
about this?
Trick question.
You talking about this part?
Is the paper in there wrong? Is the paper in there wrong?
He's breathing. Remember, these things are on their chest. So a lot of times, if they're shivering, you'll see it. If they're scratching, you'll see it. And this one just, and babies, kids have this respiratory variation all the time because they're, you know, they're breathing faster and screaming or whatever kids do. But anyway, that's just respiratory variation is what they call that. But the main thing is the junctional rhythm, as I just wanted you to see. Now, remember, in the midst of something that you don't know what the heck it is, find something that you recognize. Then go from there. Like if you were looking at this, just this rhythm, okay? Find something you recognize. That's a QRS. Would you not agree? Mm-hmm. Now, it's not normal, but it's a QRS. So then I'm going to look for a P wave. I'm going to step back and I'm going to go, okay, what's the rate here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 100. Barely a tachycardia. Y angles on the QRS. But the rate's not fast enough for it to be VTAC. That's why it's so important to start with your rate first. And then look at your rhythm. The rhythm's fine. Now I want to find my P waves. And this is where it's really handy dandy to be able to go up and change your how you're looking at the, you know, changing the what? Changing the lead. Thank you. You can kind of, again, go for a picture because you're looking for a P wave, right? And that's one reason why we put the leads where we do, because that angle from here to here comes closest to the right atrium. But there may be times when moving it might be, or just changing the lead. But you want to find a P wave, because the next question is there a QRS for every P wave? Or where's my PR interval? You know, that information is important, so you're gonna have to change that. Just so happens this is the P wave. And it is very long, but this is a junctional wave, so it's not. This sure looks like it, though. Yeah, I know. My point was showing you that, though, was that widened QRS. We're going to have more rhythms where it in clinical. Now, I will tell you, probably 75% of the rhythms that you look at are going to be sinus tachycardia. So what's the first thing you ask yourself when someone has a sinus tachycardia?
Is the patient okay?
Is the patient okay? Do they have any signs of cardiac compromise or any other issue? And I say, no, he's doing fine. Then what's your next thought? If you're thinking like a nurse, what's your next thought?
What's causing it?
What's causing it? Remember, is he got a tip? Is he in pain? I left that one off that slide. Pain's a big one. Anxiety. So, treat the cause. Now, here we get into the ventricular rhythms. This is where we get into some deep doo-doo because these are getting close to the, or part of the really lethal types of issues. Premature ventricular contractions, just as the name connotes, are premature in the cycle. They come from the ventricle. So the SA and the AV node have been bypassed. These are reentrant types of issues, meaning that the impulse the impulse comes down SA to AV normally most of the time, but before it can actually get going, remember there's an impulse wave of decolonization coming down. This one decides, no, I'm going to come over here and I'm going to take over. So that's what they mean by reentrant. This one's coming down the pipe. This area is relatively refractory. It's already been depolarized, but it's in the process of turning back over, right? So this one, down in the ventricle, decides, oh, I'm gonna come up there and I'm gonna take over. And that's what PVCs are premature ventricular contractions. Now, here's the criteria. They are, and this is an example of one. They are wide and aberrant. What's aberrant mean?
Abnormal.
Abnormal. They're premature in the cycle, wide and aberrant. There's typically a compensatory pause afterward, like the timing kind of has to reset itself. The R wave and the T wave are in opposition. Do you see that on this? R wave's going up, T wave's going way down. Early in the cycle, wide and bizarre, T wave is usually in opposition, and the compensatory pause. The real kicker, they don't perfuse. And if they do, it's very poorly. So if someone's having a lot of PVCs, like let's say bigeminy, which means every other beat is a PVC, what's that effectively do to their cardiac output? It's about half now, because half of those are not perfusing. Or, like I said, if they are, it's very, very poorly. So, clinical significance is that lack or minimal perfusion. Consider the causes. Most of the time we look at, we try to rule out at least the bad boy, which is acute ischemia. Particularly if they've already had an MI. Now, everybody has these, pretty much, because they're also very much a part of the electrolyte deficiencies that some of us run into. So hyper and hypokalemia, hypokalemia being the most common, that is a problem. Hypomagnesemia, when their mag falls down, hypoxia, acidosis, and there are some other causes like ditch tox. CMP is cardiomyopathy, which is where there's bilateral failure, right and left, and ventricular aneurysms. They can occur when they're putting in any kind of cardiac line. So you guys that are here at the bedside are putting in lines, A-lines or femoral lines or any kind of line, remember I said it's all connected. So if you increase the pressure here, it might just tick off that, and I'm going to give you a memory to it. PVCs mean that the ventricle is pissed off. Okay? PVCs pissed off.
I know that's kind of blue, but you know what? If it helps you remember, I'm all for it. The treatment, here's the deal. Amiodarone or lidocaine are both antiarrhythmics that are very effective for ventricular ectopy and ventricular dysrhythmias. Amiodarone is usually considered number one, followed by lidocaine. As I mentioned earlier, amiodarone is given 150 milligrams IV push, followed by a secondary if you need it, but most of the time they'll go ahead and put them on a continuous infusion of 1 milligram for 6 hours and then 0.5 milligram from there on. That's considered the maintenance dose. Lidocaine has been around since Jesus was a baby, and it is very faithful, but it does have some problems. A, a lot of people are allergic to any of those canes. B, it has a profile for toxicity that in the very elderly, because it is cleared through the kidney, the elderly tend to get toxic. And signs of toxicity are CNS depression. And they will, if you give too much, they'll actually start having seizures. So that's the... But now it's bad. And so is procainamide, which I hated. Procainamide is the third line drug. Prenestol is the brand name. And like Kathy said, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Now I will tell you this. The American Heart Association suggestions, the algorithms that they teach us at ACLS are based on clinical research. Thousands and thousands of research studies. And as y'all know from taking research, it doesn't prove anything. It supports, it demonstrates. So that changes on occasion based on. So they made the recommendation that we now reinsert prenestol into as a third line drug as an anti-dysrhythmic. But you'll see amiodarone used almost exclusively now. But when do we use those? Now, there are some oral agents like glucagon, Redmol that we can use as well. But in the hospital setting, there's something that we look at, and that's how pissed off is this ventricle? How irritable is it? Because we also know, remember back when we talked about PACs, we said that we thought, atrial fib might be down the pike? Well, with these, it could be VFib or VTAC that's down the pike. Okay, we need to stop that noise, decrease the irritability level just a touch with amiodarone or lidocaine. If they are having more than 6 a minute, they're having couplets, triplets, which are known as short runs of ETAC, or if they have had an MI. So we will treat PVCs if they're having couplets, and this is bijiminy. This every other beat PVC stuff, remember that halves their cardiac output. Let me show you some others that maybe demonstrate that a little bit better. Okay, one on the right, that's a couplet. But do they look the same? No, they're coming from multiple foci. That tells me that not only do I have one guy that's trying to take over, but I have another guy too. So it's even more irritable. So greater than 6 a minute, couplets, triplets, short runs of VTAC where they have 3 or 4 PVCs in a row, multifocal, they're coming from different foci, or they've had an MI. After an MI, PVCs cannot be tolerated because they will. They have much more irritable ventricle because they've had an MI already. But look at this one. That's a short run of VTAC. He does convert back, but then he has another couplet. And then he does convert back, and that's a couplet. They are univocal. They're coming from the same place, but there's too many of them. That tells us that ventricle is fixing to not do a good thing. It's too much paperwork.
Here's your warning.
Yeah, it is.
Pay attention.
So you check the patient, and what kind of things would you check?
blood pressure.
When the tech calls you and says patient A has had a 6 feet run of DTaC, you need to get up and go check your patient right away.
Yeah.
While the charge nurse is calling the doctor.
But what else could be? What else could be causing it? What else could we look at?
You want to see if he like moved the leads or something.
That's part of checking the patient. You're right. But I check his electrolytes. Is he hypokalemic? Remember? How many of these heart patients are on Lasix or Bumex? Or HCTZ at the very least? So hypokalemia is all too common. And hypomagnesemia. Now, magnesium is more often associated with torsades, but it's also another one. And I'll also check his O2 sat. Let's see if he's hypoxic. Now, you're going to have blood gases for pH to see if he's acidotic. But remember those things that can cause these very deadly kinds of things. And this is an interesting thing I got out of Dale Dugan's book, which is really a good book about little aside for one, you know.
Did you say beautiful?
Dale Dubin wrote a really good book. People are people, they're humans, I guess. But so this is the transition of this guy. And according to Dubin, this was the same patient who came in having these couplets and then started having multifocal. Do you see that? How they look different? They're premature. They're not all wide. And we can talk about that later, but those are actual PVCs. But look at the unifocal ones are for sure, but they're still not the same. See how that one's kind of notched on top? So it's considered multifocal. Then he goes into bigeminy, which cuts off half his cardiac output. But wait, there's more. And this is why I wanted to show you. Look where this one hit. Right on the T-wave. Goes into VTAC. Converts. God was with him that day. So that's how this can roll. And he's just lucky he can learn it spontaneously. Most of the time it's going to take some help. So what do we do for VTAC? Lethal and life-threatening VTAC, usually the rate is greater than 100, but it does vary. Usually not less, because it is a tachycardia by definition. The rhythm is usually regular. Now, I say that when they're on in VTAC, it's regular, but if they do happen to have short runs or runs and converts, that's not what I'm talking about. Perfusion is extremely poor, even if they do have a pulse. Now, here's where it gets a little interesting. When you're thinking about these lethal arrhythmias, the first thing we want to ask ourselves is what? How's the patient, right? And if I told you he has no pulse, you would probably, after saying a bad word, get me the car, right? So I'm going to talk about VTAC and pulse first, because that's the easier one. But it is characterized by more than three PVCs in a row. Clinical significance is that if they do have a pulse, it's not going to last for long. So if no pulse, it will be treated as VFib, which we're going to fix and talk about in just a minute. Causes can be myocardial ischemia, digitox, electrolyte imbalances, very common, potassium especially. Causes myocardial ischemia, digitox, I already said that. It can be monomorphic or polymorphic. Now that means it can look the same all the time, mono, or it can be variant. And that's what torsades is. Torsades looks like, and I have a picture of it, I think, in the next slide. It looks like a slinky that's been kind of twisted. I'll show you in a minute. But it's treated differently, though. That's an important thing to know. The polymorphic tachycardias are treated much more differently. So let's talk about VTAC without a pulse. We've got this rhythm, no pulse. What do you do first? CPR, very good. Now, remember, the trick question is to always get an indication from the question, have you checked the patient?
I just told you he had no pulse. So the assumption that I've checked the patient is there. No pulse, VTAC, crash cart. What do you do first? You defibrillate. They've got to be treated just like VFib. So you're going to leave, make sure the sync button is off, because in this case, we want to just fire. We don't want it to sit and wait for an R wave, because there is no true R wave in this pattern. So it will sit there and sit there and sit there, do nothing. So this is a true defibrillation. The safety issue with defibrillation is because the first dose with VTAC without a pulse is 200 watt seconds. That's a lot. So what are you going to do to be safe?
Clear,
all clear. Loud, make sure, and you look around, make sure nobody's leaning against the bed, not paying attention. Because you don't want to have two people on the floor needing to be defibrillated. The next thing you're going to do is, so you're going to shock at 200, then 300, then 360. You're going to check for a pulse in between. Then you're going to turn toward the drugs. Drugs that will make the heart more amenable to being defibrillated successfully. That will affect the chemical environment of the myocardium to where it will actually convert. The first drug is epinephrine. 1 in 10,000, 1 amp. And I meant to bring those ampules to show you, the emergency ampules. I'll bring one tomorrow. So, epi, and then what are you going to do? You're going to sit there?
Compressions.
You're going to do CPR, because you got to circulate it. But you got to circulate some oxygen, too. Remember? It's pump and blow. Okay. So then we're going to defibrillate again. Because remember, the drugs are to make the heart a little bit more receptive to that 360. Then we're going to shock them at 360, check pulse, and then we're going to turn toward the antiarrhythmics. First is amiodarone, 150, followed by 300 if they want to. Well, 300 will be the next cycle. 150 IV push, and then shock them again. Then we can either repeat the amiodarone, or we can switch to lidocaine. Lidocaine is going to be 75 to 100 milligrams IV push to get it's a bolus to get the blood level up, and then we'll follow with defibrillating again. So it becomes shock, drug shock, and each time you check a pulse. Okay, so we'll go through that again in just a moment with VFib, because it's the same treatment. Remember, VTAC without a pulse is treated as VFib. Now, VTAC with a pulse, I'm sitting here going, you know, I just don't feel good. I feel like, you know, I have pain in my chest and I can't hardly. You going to hit me with 100 watt seconds of energy? No. That's where you start with the drugs first. So you kind of flip it. They've got a pulse. So we'll try the amiodarone first. Then we'll try lidocaine if that doesn't work. Now, on the second dose of amiodarone, by the way, the first dose is 150. The second dose, you can escalate up to 300. And then we'll put them, if amiodarone works, we'll put them on a continuous infusion of 1 milligram for about 6 hours to make sure they get to that threshold of the appropriate blood level, and then the maintenance is half of that, so half a milligram.
Okay, this is probably dumb. Like, I'm just, so you sit, you have this rhythm, but he does not have a pulse. Like, you're not gonna feel a pulse on him. It's just because his ventricles are like quivering. Like, okay, because I was like, how does he have a rhythm without a pulse?
Remember this: ventricular beats do not perfuse very well at all. So that's why they don't have a pulse. And if they do have a pulse, it's very, very poor.
So it's not considered a pulse without that atrial.
Well, no. When you make the distinction of treatment, VTAC without a pulse, they have no pulse. They are giving you the Q sign. Do you know what the Q sign is? They are giving the O sign. You know what the O sign is? They're not conscious, is my point. I try to bring a little levity into the afternoon because I can see and feel in my own heart that I'm not conscious.
But, Annie, are you all right? For the most thing, that's really what you get.
It's like it's saying electrical pulse.
Analyzing.
Have y'all been shown how to use an AED and CPR if you're doing that, right? Okay.
Did you say you wanted to show them
the booster check things? Okay, so any questions on VTAC with a pulse or without a pulse? Think you got that algorithm down pat? We're going to go through it again. Here's some more VTAC for them. And by the way, the rhythm strips that I use on the exam are ones that you've seen before. It won't be something from completely out of left field, okay? But you can see where, I mean, that is the most perfect strip of VTAC I've ever seen. So if he doesn't have a pulse, let's say he's do-do-do-do-do-do-do along, and all of a sudden, now he had a PVC that warned us, but we didn't get much warning, and then he has an RMT, puts him into VTAC, there is no pulse. What am I going to do first? Now, here's a trick question. Do you carry the crash cart in your back pocket? So what are you going to do?
Start compression.
When I formulate these questions, you're at the bedside. And so what are you going to do first? CPR is always a good answer. Fall and call, you're going to call for help. Because you know you need that crash cart, just like you said. I need that stuff, I need all of it. Bring it now. And they used to make fun of me because my voice would go up about 2 octaves. I sound like, need a cart. But anyway, so then what are we going to do? Got the cart there, you're doing CPR. They're like, what's going on? What are you going to do now? I neglected to say that. Thank you. We do have pads that you want to place very quickly, usually anterior, posterior, or here and here. You want to stay away from pacemakers and incisions and stuff like that if you can. And they are fixed. I'll bring some tomorrow. You don't have to, do it like in the old, like the movies like to show you, like you're hanging over. That was very unsafe because when you hang over, you end up getting shocked. That's what happened. But anyway, so now they're hands off. So you have the pads that will increase the amount of energy that's emitted, but it also keeps you in the right position. That's a real important part of having a successful defibrillation, getting enough energy through that myocardium to actually get things going in the right direction. So put the pads on so you don't burn them. That's the other thing. I mean, you leave big old burns on them sometimes, even though you did use the pads. But the pads will help. So shock them at what?
200.
He has no pulse, so we're going to treat it like VFib. 200.
300,
360, and you're going to check for a pulse real quickly in between. But still in VTAC, shock them again is the way that goes. Okay, so now we're going to turn toward drugs.
Epi first.
And usually, by the way, that's when the team, like, they'll say, okay, go ahead and get the epi ready. They'll go ahead and start working on getting them intubated and maybe getting a better cannula. The trick is, do you stop doing CPR so they can get that tube in?
No.
No,
we
no,
only
no.
Stop
no.
For the clear.
Oh, great. You want to show them how to use them? And I'll pass, we'll pass these around. Some of them are dry, probably. Okay, then what are we going to do? What are we going to give first? What's the first drug that we need? Epinephrine. 1 amp. And it is, do you have the epis? You didn't bring any epis? Okay.
Hey, see the yellow?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Ooh, this is older than dirt.
I love it. You flick them off, okay?
You'll see these little yellow things all over the floor after a code, okay? All right, then you have this. You want to unscrew this. See, if you don't, look, there's a needle. So be careful when you're doing that. Because not everywhere, they have to continue to have, even though most of us are needleless, this is supposed to screw off. Okay, so then you'll have your lure lock in place, but if you're not careful, you'll pull that off, and then you'll have a mess. All right, and then you just screw it, screws in. Okay, screws in the bottom. Okay, like that. See, it has air. You have to push the air out. And then, you'll screw it in and then you'll say, and this is not the time where you go
slowly push
over 2 minutes, okay? This is not that time. This is lidocaine's in, epi's in, atropine's in. Okay. And then you just discard it. So you see there's a needle down there. So y'all, you have to be very careful. There's a needle on both ends. So it's going to hit your phone.
And then, so we give epi, then what?
Shock
them. Do some CPR. And by the way, after each medicine is given, what do you do? You flush. With what?
20 milliliters.
20 cc's of saline. And then you definitely start doing some good precautions to get that drug circulating. Then we shock them again at 360. Once you've topped out, there's no sense in going back. Then you give them what? Amiodarone.
150 IV push.
And then we think about maybe using amiodarone again or
lidocaine.
And then prednisolone or propanamide is third line. Now listen, once you've given them that dose, if they convert, let's say they convert after we gave the amiodarone to a rhythm that has a pulse, we will continue supporting them ventilator-wise, but also put them on a constant infusion of whatever dysrhythmic worked. So in this case, it might be amiodarone. So just remember, you don't just give it to them and forget about it. You give it to them, and then as soon as you can, get them on an infusion to keep this from reoccurring. We don't want to do that no more. We got other patients to take care of and other things to do. That sounds harsh, but you know.
Well, they're going to use it. They got to take it to them. Yeah. Unless they're already. You don't
want to
keep them.
Now look at this guy here. His day did not go that way. He went into DTAC, pretty, isn't it? No pulse, but then things got worse. That's ventricular fibrillation. There is no pulse, there is no R wave, there is nothing but chaos. And that's because the entire myocardium is shaking like a ball of jelly. It's just quivering because there's so much electrical activity going on and no organization to it. It's like everybody's clapping and yelling and screaming and nobody can make sense of it. So what have we got to do to keep everybody from yelling and screaming and being completely chaotic? Stop it. And what do you think we're going to do?
Defibrillation.
Defibrillating. So it's the same scenario. Confirm it. Check their pulse. You always check the patient first. There used to be a journal that was wonderful. It's called the Journal of Nursing Jocularity. They had some of the best stories that we all share when we're talking and with you guys sometimes too. And this story was particularly meaningful for me because I've had a lot of patients that have been in the unit for a few hundred days. It's like, Mr. So-and-so, get off your call bell, please. So Mr. So-and-so figured out, according to this nursing jocularity, and I can compute because I will have to tell you, I have not always run into Mr. So-and-so's room right away.
when he's on the call bill or rattling the rail. Now, you guys that are neophytes are going to think I'm awful, but there it is. So this guy that the nursing jocularity people, he discovered that that didn't work anymore. They didn't come running every time he rattled the rail. So he figured out real quick, all he had to do was scratch. And it made it do that. So they had to come check on him. Anyway. So that is DFib, and there is no pulse. There's nothing but chaos. And there it is. So it's legal and life-threatening. It is also, by the way, according to the American Heart Association, the number one cause of sudden cardiac death in those some 625,000 people who die every year. The rate is very fast because it is complete chaos. There's no organized pattern. So you can't find a PR, well, you can't find an RA or nothing but chaos. The clinical significance is they don't have a pulse. So there's no perfusion. The immediate treatment is defibrillation and CPR. So what are we going to do first?
Call for
CPR. Then we're going to call for the cart because we know we need the defibrillator. So we're going to shock him, put the pads on, shock him with what first?
200.
300, 360. I think y'all got it by Jove. The first drug to give?
Epinephrine.
Epi. The first antidysrhythmic?
Amiodarone
or lidocaine. That is a user's choice. And sometimes the team leader is a physician who has had success with that drug and is comfortable with it. So don't get all fired up if he goes outside the algorithm. American Heart algorithms are highly noted, supported suggestions only. There will be times that we'll go completely out of the box to try and save people, especially kids. I've seen them go through three carts and put a kid on bypass to try to warm him up, which is not in the algorithm at all. So it can get pretty hairy. Now, VFib, as time goes on, will change from this coarse look to a fine VFib. The best responses have come from coarse VFib. So if we can catch them and catch them fast, the likelihood of turning around is relatively successful. I had a guy that was a golfer out on the base, and he was living right because he decided to have a big MI and defibrillate right there on the golf course. Guess who was in the group behind him? Two or three doctors. That's luck if you ever. So they start doing bystander CPR very effectively. As soon as they saw the guy go down, fire department got there with an AED. He turned around with the first shot. So that's how time is so important, and the support. If you do high quality basic CPR, it's not going to be like Mother Nature, but with outcomes, and you're going to see this over and over, bound down at home, and we don't know how long, and no bystander CPR. The fire department get them back, but you have to ask yourself, how long was he hypoxic? How much of a hit did his brain take, did his kidneys take, and so forth. So there will be times where ethically you wonder, did we do them any favors by resuscitating? But just remember, if you're doing your job and you get in there quick and do the right things in the right order, the chances are pretty good. And this is one. But with coarse, we get pretty good outcomes. Fine, not so much. So that's what epinephrine might do, is change that fine VFib back to a coarse VFib, is what some of the studies have indicated. So this one's pretty interesting to me. Look at that one. That's a classic RNT. But he has an ST segment that's pretty high too, so sounds like he had some issues before he went into VFib. So you defib, BFib, right?
So when you said we get pretty good outcomes, you're talking about with the CPR and the defibrillation, you get good outcomes with the coarse, but not so much with the fine.
Right.
Okay.
But they keep that, and they'll give them epi. And epi can be repeated every 3 to 5 minutes. So it doesn't always follow that epi, amiodarone. It doesn't follow that all the time. Certainly if amiodarone hasn't worked, you go with the others. But epi can be repeated every 3 to 5. So you'll, that's when you'll find them repeating that epi, trying to get them out of that fine detail.
So you said the top two are coarse?
Yeah.
Is the one on the bottom fine? Or is
no,
it just...
the one on the bottom is that polymorphic. Like it looks like torsades.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. You can get 2 or 3 people in the same room and they go, no, that's torsades. And that happened to me with a renal failure patient put on levoquin. And the night nurse before me said she keeps going in and out of ETAP. And the physician, who I think was the nephrologist, I can't remember, kept saying she's in VTAC. So they were treating her like she was in VTAC. Here comes Corky Davis, a cardiologist. No, nope, that's torsades. Get her off the levoquin and put her on that, that, that. And I'm like, give her some MAG. That's the treatment for torsades, by the way, is magnesium sulfate. Y'all have given that before, so you know how you give it. Piggyback, fast or slow? Slow, over 4 hours, no more. 2 grams over 4 hours for torsades. No, I'm sorry, I'm bouncing. Let me get back on task. As Renee tells me, stick with the PowerPoint, Patty. All right, do I need to even ask how we treat these now? No, y'all know detail. Asystole is a pretty ominous, life-threatening as well. The rate is zip. The rhythm is zip, the pulse is zip. It is confirmed in 2 leads, however, because it can be fine V5. So it's just before we go down the wrong path, we're gonna make sure you don't shock asystole, but you do confirm that is indeed asystole by looking at it in another lead. Does that make sense to y'all? Hollywood, they always want to shock everything. But this one, there is no electrical activity, so shocking them will not have a good outcome most of the time, or any of the time, actually. So there's no perfusion. Now, what we'll look at is what's causing it, because we do know that there are specific causes for asystole that might be treatable. The number one is blood loss. My stepbrother decided to park his car around a telephone pole somewhere between here and Maine. And a little bit of Quaaludes and beer, he told me later. But anyway, so he is on the scene, just wrecked. C5, I mean, they didn't know the full extent on the scene, but they did know that he had some serious injuries. Took him to Little Fraser Hospital. Someone, I wish I knew who, said, no, this kid needs to go north now. He arrested as soon as he got out of it. He was actually still in the ambulance. And I tell this story because it was written up, and the two residents who were in the ER that night, Charlie Black and Baron O'Neill, said, we're going to go for broke. This is a 20-something-year-old, they could tell by looking, he's a young kid. What had happened is he had bled out from his spleen. He was asystole for 10 minutes, supported by first CPR and then internal massage while they got him up to OR, resected his spleen, and the next night, the little twit got up, extubated himself, took his chest tube out, and called his nurse the B word. That did not get him final points. But anyway, he was not a very nice patient. But that's sometimes the case. People are in crisis. They do the most harsh and awful things that they would never do. Now, he would have done those things if he wanted. God rest his soul. He died of an MI at 41. So it was not an easy life. But I thought it was really interesting because these can turn around. So number one causes trauma and blood loss. So what do you think we're going to do for them before we call the coroner? Give them fluid, lots of fluid. Fluid, fluid, fluid. Then there are what's called the H's and T's. Help me with this, Kathy.
H's and
T's. H's and T's.
Hypoxia.
Hypoxia, I'll echo. You
no,
say
no, 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 no. Let's see. Hypoxia, hypovolemia, hypoxia,
acidosis,
toxicity,
tamponade, the H's and T's.
Wait,
see, I think I've got it.
Here you go.
Okay, H is in last night.
I should have it on here every
4 and 4. It used to be 5 and 5, but it's 4 and 4. So the H's are hypoxia, hypovolemia, hyperkalemia,
hypothermia.
Hypometabolic.
Hyperkalemia.
Okay. Oh, that's what they're doing metabolic, where we used to do hydrogen. Okay. Yeah. All right. Hydrogen for acidosis. All right. So H's again, hypoxia, hypovolemia, hyperkalemia, hydrogen for metabolic acidosis, then thrombosis, coronary or pulmonary, tamponade, cardiac, toxins, and attention pneumothorax.
So H's and T's.
So
here's the deal. If someone has got blood loss, you give them fluid. If they're hypoxic, what do you think we do?
Oxygen.
Give them oxygen. Hyperkalemic. Get the dialysis people to come in and do emergency dialysis. Hypothermia, warm them up, and that's what they did for this kid that I was telling you about a while ago. He was drug out of the lake and was way hypoxic, and they put him on bypass to try to warm him up before they called it. Tamponade, you're going to fix the tamponade. Toxins, the ones that are really bad are the, what's Elavil? Because they're cardiotoxic. Tricyclic antidepressants, because they're cardiotoxic, and they'll put them in. And then attention pneumothorax. I like this. This is a little website that she got. So, in asking you that question, I'm going to have to give you a little bit about the background of the patient. But I can tell you the number one cause, especially of those we successfully bring back. Now, that's a very big caveat. Not too many people come back from this history. I've got to tell you, it's not a real high success rate. Make sure we get all those booster jets back down the wood. So that's what we're going to do. And CPR, and the one medication that we can try is epinephrine. That's the only medication that has any offering of being successful, is that in addition to treating the cause. So what if the monitor shows this? What are you thinking? What is that?
Looks like atrial flutter.
But what's the first thing you do?
Is the patient okay?
Check the patient. And he doesn't have a pulse. But he has a rhythm. Why doesn't he have a pulse? And I can see a lot of people standing there going, what? No. He's got to have a pulse. He's got a rhythm. No, it's called pulseless electrical activity. It's treated just like asystole. The problem here is, unlike asystole, there's nothing wrong with the myocardium. There's nothing wrong with the conduction system, I should say. The conduction system is fine. It's the circumstances around the myocardium. So we're kind of back to the H's and T's with a few little variations. So we're going to try to treat what's going on with them. And we see PEA a lot of times in trauma cases as well. They'll often go into PEA and then into asystole.
So is this basically, the heart is, we're shooting that electrical current, we're saying you need to beat, but then the heart's not actually beating.
Well, picture it this way. They've lost so much circulating blood. What was the first thing we said that the heart had to have?
It's got to have resistance.
No, got to have fluid.
Fluid.
Got to have something to pump.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that's wrong with PEA is, it can look like any rhythm. So that's why it's so important to check for that pulse first before you go down the wrong path. Okay? So it's pulseless electrical activity. The intervention could be epinephrine, but then we're back to the H's and T's. Know the norms. Go back and review your norms if you haven't already. So know the numbers. If I told you somebody had a 6.8 potassium, what would you want to do for them? isolate and D50 and insulin, right? And make sure that you watch their rhythm very closely because they might just have problems. All right, any questions about anything we've talked about? So, lethal, common, VTAC, VFib, asystole, PEA. Common would be atrial fib and atrial flutter, particularly AFib. Sinus bradycardia, sinus tachycardia. Did that help narrow the focus a little bit?
Did we skip the tarsiasis slide?
No, I think I might have moved it.
Yeah, I think it's moved, but it's
I'm sorry. After the jug of red cat. Anyway, now we're going to talk about the blocks, the true blocks that we talked about, atrial ventricular blocks. Now, these usually arise from something they're either born with, some kind of genetic defect. Anything about that, it just is. Or scar tissue of some manner. There is a miscommunication or a slowing of the wave of impulse from the atria to the ventricle, from the SA node to the AV node, and even down into the Purkinje system. So there are three types. And the one that's lethal, potentially, is complete heart block, or what some people call third degree AV block, or what some people even call AV dissociation. They're divorced from each other. That's the one that's lethal. Okay? But leading up to that, and the way that I would suggest you learn this, is that a lot of people have first degree. First degree, the PR interval is prolonged. It's fine, everything else is fine. Their rate may be a little slow, but not too bad. R to R is regular. PR interval is prolonged. It's greater than 0.20. Consistently the same, however, we're gonna look at some strips in a minute, but it's just longer. So the secret is in the PR interval when you're trying to figure out which one is a block. And by the way, waking up, here's a question for you. What drug did we say was very high in probability of causing these kinds of dysrhythmias? Good. First degree, PR interval's fine, it's just longer than 0.20. Second degree, little bit more delay, and that's called Winkelbach, after Dr. Winkelbach. And there's a little ditty that goes with it. Longer block, then you have Winkelbach, and I'll show you that in a minute. The degree of blockage is a little higher. Usually there's no clinical significance or treatment for it. We just watch them. But the PR interval will start out long, and then it gets longer, and then it drops a beat because that communication with that wave of depolarization from SA to AV gets greater and greater. It's like somebody hung up on you. You know, you're waiting, and I'm gonna hang up now. That's my metaphor, but I like theirs better. Longer block, then you have wavy block. Type 2 Mobitz is a little bit more. Now that's where we start looking at maybe putting a pacer in because it is very high, but if they go into type 2, I might want to put a star by that, because if they go into type 2, their likelihood of going into complete is pretty high. So the PR interval is consistent, but there's more of them. Let me show you. Here's first degree. You see how it looks perfectly normal, and when you look at that PR interval, you'll discover, and when you get home, I want you to pull this out and measure it, and you'll find that it's 0.24. Let's see. Yeah, it's about 2.24. A little bit longer. And it's consistent, it's the same. If you walk it out with your little piece of paper, it's the same. It's always 0.24. Non-significant. Clinically, I shouldn't say non, it doesn't have any major complications with it at all. And there's no treatment required. Now type 2, remember that's Winkelbach. So if you look at that one, you see how when you first look at it, you can see where there's something with that pause there, right? Well, let's work forward. See how this one over here is long? It's a
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Actually, it's about 0.24. Then it gets longer and longer, and then you have a drop B. Everybody see that? That's winky drop. Now, if you're wondering, you can always work backwards. You can go, well, there's something wrong there. So now, if I work backwards, it's going to get shorter and shorter and shorter. But I like longer, longer, because it goes with that. Then you have winky bop. No real treatment required. They're usually very stable, and there is a very, very low risk of it going any further toward complete. Second degree, though, does. And in second degree, or the second degree MUB is type 2, you're going to have a PR interval that's typically normal. Well, these are winky bop examples. I'm sorry. I thought I'd put it over. You see that that's a winky bop, long, longer drop. Then you have winky bop. I have a slide that shows all of them so you can compare and contrast. There's type 2. You see what is going on there? Rate is 50. R to R is irregular. And the why it's irregular is because there's extra P's in there. You see that? When you ask yourself, is there a QRS for every P? The answer is no. That guy over there, he has no QRS. Neither does that guy right there. But the PR interval is consistent when there is one. But you have extra P's. So that's a little bit worse, wouldn't you say? I mean, when you think about communication, if it's losing that much communication between the atria and the ventricle, that's getting a lot more serious than a winky bop, or certainly than a first degree.
Because it's delayed so much that it's not even getting through.
Oh, and the thing that goes with that is, out of the blue, it drops a Q.
On the other one, though, the first, the type 1, there wasn't a QRS for every P. Is it just because there's more in the type 2?
Well, it's a higher grade because if you look at, there's winky bop, is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, there's one in the middle of that one, but on the next one, there's like two or three of them.
Yeah, because so MUB is one, I like to look at it this way. This couple, they've been married a while, okay? And he starts coming home later and later and later. But he comes home every night. But he's consistently longer than what he should be, but he's still coming home every night. Well, then he starts coming home later and then later and later, and then he didn't come home at night. And then he comes home and it's later and it's later, and then he didn't come at night. Well, then they have a row. Well, then after that, he says, okay. So he comes home consistently, and then he doesn't come home. And then he'll come home consistently, and then he won't come home. And then it just implodes, and
they end up divorced.
And then there goes
dissociation.
She's doing her thing, and he's doing his thing. They're just kind of like cohabitating.
Yeah.
So let's look in this. I'm going to flip over here to third degree. Okay? Here's second degree type 2. Now you're wondering, how in the world am I going to put this together? I'll show you how. With type 2, remember out of the blue, it drops a Q. The P interval's fine. It's just out of the blue, it drops a Q. There is no building up to it like with winky bop, where it gets late, longer, longer, longer drop, then you have winky bop.
Okay?
So this is a higher degree of blockage, and therefore needs usually to have a pacemaker or some type of treatment. So that it's kind of a safety net.
Are they Brady?
Yeah, unless they have some kind of escape. All right, third degree, life-threatening and serious. There is complete dissociation between the atria and what's going on with the SA and AV node and the ventricle. And here's what you'll see. You'll see, and I like that one better, but I can reach this one. The PR is never, when you look at the rate, it's going to be very slow because it's coming from the ventricle. And it's going to be very wide and irregular because it's coming from the ventricle. The ventricle has an inherent rate of what? Well, let's think about it. Let's work backwards. What's the inherent rate of the SA node? 60 to 100. What's the inherent rate of the AV node if it's driving the ship?
40 to 60.
40 to 60. What's the inherent rate of the ventricle?
20.
So it's going to be very low. This is a little faster than, that's more like what you'll see. But you've got R to R, looks okay. It's a bradycardia. And whenever it's a bradycardia, the first thing that comes to my mind is it a block? So I start looking at that PR interval because that's where the key is in the PR interval. So in this one, I have a PR interval that looks short, and then I have this guy, and I ask myself, is there a QRS for every P? Well, there kind of looks like it, but if I do a PR interval, this is short, this is long, the next thing I do is I do a little P to P thing. P to P, here's another P. Right on top of the T wave. Here's another P. Here's another P buried right there. And then here's a P. So they're, like she said, they're just doing their own thing. The inherent rate of the SA node is 80, so it's clicking along at 80. The ventricle's doing its own thing at whatever ventricular rate, usually in the 30s, like the top one. So the top one you can see even better, I think, because it was. Those P's are just, and one real dead giveaway is when the QRS is changed, like this one, right? No, right here. When the QRS looks different all of a sudden, you're like, wait a minute, is there a P in there? So with this one, they'll usually be hypotensive. They will have clinical signs and symptoms fairly quickly because the cardiac output is so low with a complete heart block. So they will have to be supported. So what do you think we're going to do?
Pacemaker.
But we're going to have to get somebody that knows about pacemakers. If the situation is dire, like they are fixing to die, we can use what's called transcutaneous pacing, and Denise Jones will talk about that with pacers. But the definitive and best option is to treat them. We can give them atropine, that usually does nothing. We can put them on dopamine and epidrip while we're waiting on somebody to put in a temporary pacer. Usually doesn't take very long because it is a medical emergency. And so they'll usually get there and get it done as quick as possible. So that's the only block that, and again, remember, not all of these are going to be interpretations. Some of them will be by criteria. So if I told you somebody, a woman who had an MI that affected her left ventricle, we'll talk about names later, developed a rhythm where the rate was 36, her blood pressure is 90 over 40. Respirations are 28 a minute. O2 status 89. There is no coordination between PR to PR. There's no consistent measurement with the PR interval, nor is there any consistency with QRS. There is not a QRS for every P.
Third degree AV block.
Does everybody kind of see how that criteria would go down? So when you, and this is where working from flashcards is really a good way to study. You know, cut and paste a strip and on the back of it put the criteria. And then get someone to blow, not only recognizing and interpreting, but looking on the criteria. And I can tell you, and I want to, because I don't want you to have a conniption fit or a stroke, or any of those other anxiety-producing bad things, I very rarely ask for recognition on the blocks. The most common way that I attach that is by criteria. Do I need to say more about that? So don't worry so much. I do want you to know the criteria, though. And that's pretty much the way NCLEX will attack rhythms as well. Won't always be recognition, but it certainly could be, very well be, with the lethal and common. So here they are all together. So let's look at it just for a second. Start from the bottom. What's the rate? That ain't so healthy, is it? No. Now, what's the next thing in our system?
Everything does not happen.
Rhythm.
We're doing R to R. Make sure our rhythm, and our rhythm's slow, but regular. Is there a QRS for every P?
No.
No. So then you automatically know it's a block. So then you look at your PR interval, because that is the key. PR interval is, it looks kind of the same. If you look at this, and that's characteristic of a mode that's type 2. But look at all these extra P waves. That's why the rate's so slow, is because it's such a high degree of blockage. You've got three P waves before you get, only every fourth wave, the polarization wave, is getting through. That's pretty severe. They'd end up getting a pacer. What about the middle? You've seen that one before, and remember what I said, the ones on the test, you'll have seen as well.
Which middle one?
I'm sorry. The second one down. You got me there.
Longer winky box?
Yeah, winky box.
Everybody see that? Longer drop. Then you have winky box. What do we do about winky box? Just watch them. They're okay. And very rarely do they get any worse. What about this bottom one?
That's third degree. That's third
the one
degree.
We just looked at, right? But if you look at the criteria, it's slow. There's no association between what's going on with the ventricle and the atrium. In other words, there's not a QRS for every P. PR interval's never the same, or rarely. So the rest of these, 319. What's the one on the bottom? Name that strip.
Atrial flutter? No.
Do they have a pulse?
They do have a pulse. Good idea. What's the rate? 80. What's the rhythm?
It's irregular.
Where's the P wave? No discernible P wave. So what's that make it? Atrial fib. Irregular, no discernible P wave. What's the top one? What's the top one? The rate is 40. Regular, but where's the P wave? So what's that make it? It's a junctional. What do we do about those guys? Put a pacer in them. What do we do about the AFib guy? Well, let's check our patient first. Let's see if he's symptomatic. If he's, really having trouble, like with his blood pressure, chest pain. What else did we say was in our cardiac compromise box?
Diaphoretic.
Chest pain.
Did I say chest pain already?
So he's all that. What do you think we're going to do now for atrial fib?
You're going to give him a bandage.
It's going to take 3 days for that to work. That's when we might, if they're showing signs, we might decide to cardiovert them first. We'll try drugs, and Cardiozym does work very quickly. So they'll usually kind of, they'll be moving pretty fast. They won't wait around. So they'll try the Cardiozym or the amiodarone. And if they don't convert within just a few minutes or so, maybe an hour, then they'll start talking about maybe cardioverting them. But here's the deal. What do we know about new onset AFib? Y'all don't know much of anything yet because you haven't read the book. But I'll tell you. What's happening in the atrium?
It's clotting.
There's clots in both right and left chambers. What could happen if we shock them? All of a sudden, they're in sinus rhythm. So what do you think we're going to do before we're going to use drugs?
Blood thinner.
We're going to do a TEE, a transesophageal echo, to see if there's clots in there. Because if there are, we need to heparinize them. We need to do something to minimize the risk of stroke or for other thromboembolic events. So that's where that CHAD scale came from. We've got to have some way of saying if he's at high risk, we need to go this way. He's at low risk, we need to go that way. Because with these medical treatments, it's a matter of a lot of times just guesswork and going with the recommendations of the ACL, of the American Heart, giving them some information to support what they do. Because the risk when you cardiovert someone with AFib is always that they could have a stroke and a complete shower of clots. And there's nothing more heartbreaking than that, truly. So they'll try to do an echo. At the very least, it may not be a TEE. It may just be a 2D M-mode echo at the bedside, you know, an echocardiogram. They can visualize big clots with that. So I want you to go back and remember this throughout this course. You need to be sure and look up the procedures that we talk about as far as pre-procedure nursing issues as well as post-procedure. So what do you do to get them ready? Do they need to be NPO, that kind of thing? Or do you need to get the crash cart in the room? What do you want to have readily available, equipment-wise? So, question. What if you have somebody and we're doing an elective cardioversion for AFib? We've decided there's no big clots in there and we're good to go with cardioverting. What are you going to do? What are you going to have readily available?
Oxygen.
What's the biggest safety issue with cardioversion?
Sync button.
The synchronization button.
Having the sync button on would be the answer to that question. But when you do that, this is what happens, this guy in the middle. Now what are you going to do? Start CPR, and you're going to turn the sync button off because you're going to have to defibrillate. Now, here's the good thing with that. Almost all the defibrillators that I know of in the market default back to defibrillation. That's why it's so important for you to remember that safety thing with cardioversion. Because you've got to, if you're cardioverting someone who has a pulse, you'd really like to keep that pulse, right? Something is better than nothing. So turn the sync button on. If you're going into a cardioversion, the risk is always there that they will throw clots if it's atrial fib or deteriorate into and go into VFib. Okay? So even with the best of technique, I'm saying that's the worst case that can happen.
Well, I guess death is really pretty good. But anyway, I was just thinking that's always on the carpet. You know, you can have this morning the original and death. Crazy. Okay, Renee will never forgive me because I'm not speaking. Anyway, so it goes into VFib. Now, what are we going to do? Make sure that sync button is off so that we, because we know the next thing we need to do is defibrillate. And we're going to go down that algorithm. It's really kind of, I don't know if any of y'all have been around the ER, I thought I asked, but it's really kind of anticlimactic. Don't you think, Kathy? I mean, with the pads and the distance, you're just hitting the button.
Yeah, it's not nearly as much fun as it used to be. Where you hold pals like this and some idiot says, well, what happens if you do this? And then you hit the button and it just kind of marks and...
Wow.
And now you're coding another person said he's shocked himself.
No, you know, they didn't have to code one.
Is the bottom one all right. Fib? Or?
Yeah, the bottom the top one is V-fib. Everybody agree on that? Perfect chaos.
The top one is V.
Y'all know that one backwards and forwards. Know the difference. That is one, if I had to pull what you would see on implant sounds, I would think that'd be one. It's luck of the draw.
Because you're not safe to practice if you can't recognize when your patient has
Now those are, I'll let y'all look at those at home. But if you can't decipher it, don't worry about it. It's a type of, well, this is AFib, but the other ones are blocks. And here's a little piece about V-waves and there's a creating block. I just threw in some stuff that might be helpful. Now, y'all want to take a break? It's 3:30. Do I have any nays to that movement, that motion? What? She said four?
When did she say that? She didn't tell us that.
I know. All right. So what's that second one off the top?
The second one is
What's that one from the cheap seats back there? What's that second one down on the left? Huh? What is it? Sawtooth F waves, regular rhythm, atrial flutter. Now what are we going to do about it?
Is that the one where you have the retrograde teeth?
Well, think about it. You've got an atrium that's just kind of jiggling around. And so what could you do on that would maybe stop all that stuff?
Oh, okay. I was like, it feels like it. It's my
an atrial ventricular anti-dysrhythmic, like amiodarone. Or a calcium channel blocker like cardiazid, diltiazid. Because it's real easy to get your drugs confused. So on the back of those flashcards, write the treatment. Real big. Amiodarone, adenocar, and just think about what is it I want to do. If you want to slow something down, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers. You've been talking about that since level 2 in pharmacology. You want to speed it up? Y'all all knew atropine. What you might not have known is that we use dopamine because we're using it for a side effect or epinephrine until we can get somebody who can put a pacer in, like for the symptomatic bradycardia. All right, this is just, what's this and what do we do about it? By Jiminy PVCs. Does everybody see that?
That's
so if you're documenting that, you could put by Jiminy with unifocal PVCs. Do you see that? They're all the same. So they're coming from the same place, which is good news, but there's a lot of them. That's bad news. So what are we going to do to kind of chill out that ventricle? What drug chills out the ventricle?
Amiodarone.
Now we could also use lidocaine, but remember lidocaine has that problem with CNS depression and toxicity, especially in the elderly. But amiodarone is not all, you know, all a good thing. What's the major side effect of amiodarone? Heart blocks and pulmonary toxicity. It also has this weird thing, and y'all are going to read about this, maybe. If they've been on it for a while, y'all didn't fess up to ever having given it. But if they've been on it for about 6 months, sometimes it'll turn their skin blue. Is that not wild or what? It's not like Blue Man or, you know, Smurf blue. It's like cyanotic blue. My IV. All right, so what's this one right here?
Yes,
VT.
Who should I pick on now? You guys, what is that?
Y'all have been which
part? SVT. So what are we going to do about it? They say it's SVT, but it does have that little slower part. So that kind of makes you think that she can hurt it, and it's a periodic or a paroxysm.
So the treatment's not going to be.
So what are you going to do to this good little lady? Put her down. But then she keeps doing it. And she keeps going into a rate that's like 180-something. So what are we going to give her then? Huh? Oh, I'm never going to forget that. They say, why should I get, what do y'all say? My goodness. How do you give
ideas? Push it fast.
That's right.
Say it fast.
And
push it fast.
You wait for that big pause where everybody doesn't breathe.
They call it the sphincter clicker.
And remember, they can have so we do want to tell them. I think when we were talking about this earlier, she said you want to be sure and educate them, and that's true. You do want to tell them. You know, you may feel a little bit of chest pressure when this works. So they'll know what's coming, because they usually do have a flush or even chest pain, just for a minute when that slows down. There's a longevity guy here. All right, what are we gonna do for this guy? This is a little old lady that lived under the bridge in a box. And she came in, and this is 3 weeks ago. So what are we going to do? What is it? What are we going to do?
Asystole.
Huh?
Which one did you want to do?
What's the
asystole?
We're going to do CPR.
Find out where they're bleeding.
Give her epi. You can try epi.
See if they're bleeding.
Now, wait a minute. She lived in a box under the bridge. And it's 3 weeks ago.
You remember what happened 3 weeks ago?
Snowstorm.
Oh.
Oh, actual 3 weeks ago.
Warm her up. How can we warm somebody up really fast but safely? Bear hugger. Well, we could get pretty aggressive in the ER. And Kathy can attest to this. We could actually put them on bypass, like I was telling you about that kid. That takes a little bit of work. But what we also can do is warm up their IV fluids. And by the way, you don't put them in the microwave. Okay? There are better ways to warm up IV fluids.
I used to work at a place where the warmer, the top shelf of the warmer was for the normal saline, and then the bottom part was
for the normal saline. Everybody
had
warm.
There was Southwest.
All right, here's some questions. Just like you'll see on the test. All right, this question is for this side. We're going to work on signs here. Which ventricular dysrhythmia is more likely if a patient has a prolonged QT interval? And what do we do to treat torsades? Magnesium sulfate, 2 to 4 grams over 4 hours. Very slow. Now, you know what? That mag got carried, I got carried away with that mag, and I think he got it too fast, so now he has no DTRs. What do I do?
There's no what?
Mag toxicity. What do you do? Calcium what? Very good. Always know your reversals in this class, too. If there's a reversal, you need to know it, because it's going to be the next thing the PA can ask you. The other thing is with mag is that we do watch their urine output, too. Remember? Now, I know y'all thought that you were out of OB. Same drug, just a different circumstance. Same side effects if we let it get too far or too fast. All right. So what drugs come to your mind that could cause torsades? Anything yet? You haven't studied? Antipsychotics. That's because y'all just came out of psych and you've been given these. Did y'all get a chance to give the meds, actually, or no? So that's kind of hard to learn something for me if I don't have ownership of it, if somebody else is giving it. So just remember, those are some heavy-duty drugs, and I have a lot of safety issues. So when you go to studying for the comp predictor and all that later on, the med surge that you see in this semester is just the med surge. So I don't think you're going to see
what's that. What's the name of the drug? I'm blanking on it. When no other drugs are working to convert someone with chronic atrial fib, and they bring them in because they have to do morning 12-lead EKGs to check the QT interval, and if it's too long, then they can't get the drug because the drug will most likely start with a D, most likely cause sequencing kinds of questions, okay? Not a lot, not 50 of them, but let's put this in order. So,
three.
And by the way, our select all apply, and you probably have seen this, if you don't get a selection like that, you have to just type them in order, okay? So what are we gonna do first? What is that rhythm first and foremost? And what do you do first?
You're going to check for unconsciousness and lack of pulse.
You're going to check your patient first, right? It could be a lead that's off. It could be he's scratching. Huh?
Because it's if they're scratching the lead.
Yeah. So what's the next thing we're going to do?
Start CPR.
Call
for help.
Then what? We're going to start CPR, call for help, volunteer.
Get the code blue card.
Defibrillate. And then check the patient for IV access so that we can push the drugs.
Does
Does everybody, I mean, kind of agree with that?
Could you not, like, call for help as you run into STAR CPR? I mean, that's not an option. I'm just saying.
Well, I mean, that's what you should do anyway. I mean,
I think you can do a lot of things at the same time.
You're not leaving the room. So, you're checking the patient, you're starting CPR, there's a thing over the bed that calls a code, you yell out, I need a crash cart. Somebody's going to hear you, but you never leave the patient.
Right. But I just meant, like, he could be like, help, 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 oh my God. You
know? Well, don't do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you yell really loud. I mean, the most you could do is you step out and go, I need the crash cart. First time you say, I need the crash cart, somebody's coming. Bring the crash cart. Somebody's coming.
All right, this one's for you guys. Your patient has the heart rhythm noted below. What assessment would you be sure to conduct because of this rhythm? Select all that apply. What's that rhythm?
That's a little block.
What's the rate? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
80.
So that's okay. What's the rhythm?
The rhythm is irregular.
Irregular. There you go. Now, is there a QRS for every P, or do you want to look at your PR intervals first? That's fine. Where's the P?
It's
this is their question. It's atrial fibrillation. It's irregular, no discernible P wave. Now, the question is asking you, what assessment would you be sure to conduct because of this rhythm? So what do you want to know about somebody that's in atrial fib? Do you want to know, and remember, yes, no. Do you want to know their blood pressure? Yeah, because they just lost 30% of their cardiac output. Do you want to know the baseline level of consciousness? Yes, he could have a stroke. Urinary output? Not so much, not in this regard, unless you're really worried about cardiac output. But that's color of extremities? Yes, because of the danger of thromboembolic. And you know what happens more often than stroke even? It's called blue toe. Straight to their feet. It's that statistically common. Thank goodness it's not the stroke part. Medication profile?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to need to know that because that could be the cause. All right. Your turn. Interpret the rhythm depicted below. What is that? So what is that? It's a bradycardia, but is it sinus? Yes. Yeah, we got a nice speed wave. It's not very cool, I think. Now, if the above patient was said to be symptomatic, what symptoms would you be looking for?
A.
Chest pain, yes.
B. Not necessarily E, but maybe.
Does everybody agree with A, B, C, D?
Yes.
You think that's true?
No, I wouldn't get anything with D, but yeah, I said it would be
A, B, C, D.
Okay, so that's kind of how the testing goes. And tomorrow, all that stuff that we talked about.
What was the answer
to that one?
Okay. Now, tomorrow, you're going to come in and do your MedCalc test, right? Everybody's going to pass it so we can move on. Then, we're going to meet back in here, long about 10 o'clock.